You're listening to the Divorce and Your Money Show, the number one podcast that discusses the complex business of divorce. I'm your host, Sean Lehman, MBA and certified divorce financial analyst. One of the most important questions I get from you doesn't have to deal with dividing property, has nothing to deal with who gets the house or how much support one person's going to pay or receive, or any of the financial stuff that I like to talk about. It actually has to do with something different. And it has to do with how do you protect your personal information and keep it personal, particularly when you're dealing with a spouse or soon-to-be ex-spouse that knows everything about you, knows your email addresses, knows your phone numbers, knows your living history, knows your relatives. And how do you keep your identity safe? How do you keep your bank account safe? And how do you keep your computer safe and all of the electronic communications, not only as you go through the divorce process, but afterwards? And so I want to bring you some of the top experts in the field when it comes to cybersecurity. And I have with me Sean Bailey and Devin Kropp. They are the authors of an excellent book called Hack Proof Your Life Now. And it talks about rules for cybersecurity and key things when it comes to your email address, your bank account, your phone numbers, all of these different areas of cybersecurity that you need to be thinking about. And most people don't even do the basics. And I understand because it's complicated. But in this interview, we're going to get into some of the major areas that you should be thinking about. And actually, I really encourage you to go get the book, Hack Proof Your Life Now, because it's very easy to read and actionable. It teaches you step by step all of the different accounts you need to protect and things you need to be thinking about to ensure that you keep your information secure. So without further ado, here is my interview with Sean and Devin. Today on the show, I have with me Sean Bailey and Devin Kropp. They are the authors of the book Hack Proof Your Life Now, The New Cybersecurity Rules Protect Your Email, Computers, and Bank Accounts from Hacks, Malware, and Identity Theft. Sean and Devin, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thanks.
So why don't we start with just a little bit of background. Tell us how you came to this book and writing about it.
Well, Devin and I work for a company here in Manhattan called Horse's Mouth, and the main mission of our company is to help financial planners create educational content to teach their clients and the public. So I've been a journalist for 30 years and have written extensively at certain points during my career about fraud over the years, and I've been in computers and actually using computers very early on to analyze government data and do investigative reporting. So I've had familiarity with fraud and computers. And then, you know, I've been working here at Horse's Mouth for 18 years. And, you know, over the years, the issue of hacking and identity theft has become, you know, more and more serious. And we started to see, leading up to around 2013, that stories about hacking and, you know, people losing money in any variety of ways through making mistakes or just in general having poor security on their computers, that sort of thing was growing in frequency. And we began to think, all right, well, who is it in the public's world that should be the person teaching people or nudging people to do better with their cybersecurity? And when you think about it, if there's any professional, it's not going to be your doctor or your dentist. It's going to be a person in your community who helps you with your finances and financial planning and that sort of stuff. So we decided to create a workshop that financial planners could deliver in their community. And the workshop was called 1 Hour to Savvy Cybersecurity. And what Devin works with me as an associate editor here at Horse's Mouth, where I'm the editor-in-chief. And we created this program, and what we wanted to do and what we believed as we started to look at the issue was that there are actually a handful of important, easy-to-do things that will dramatically boost people's security, even though whenever they're written about constantly on the internet or whatever the case may be, or you hear about it on radio and TV, you always get the scare, but you hardly ever get the solution. And there are a lot of easy solutions out there that can go a long way to building an effective cybersecurity fortress around your private life. So that's kind of how we got into it.
No, I think that's great. And I think you're right in that you hear all the news stories or you see the advertisements from various companies, but it's hard to figure out in one consolidated way what you can do to protect yourself. And so what we'll do today is get into some of the main topics in the book. There's no way we can cover everything. There's a lot of information in there. But let's just start with a few different categories. And one of the questions that I get from people that I work with, also as a financial advisor, but particularly in a divorce situation, is that here's the question I get is, my ex-spouse knows everything about me. How do I protect my identity? And I know there's a lot of facets and you have some recommendations, but you know, I see on TV every day commercials for LifeLock. Why can't we just all sign up for LifeLock and call it a day?
Yeah, well, LifeLock is, we devote the very last chapter of our book, which, by the way, we decided to write the book because we were creating a presentation called 1 Hour to Savvy Cybersecurity, and it was so well received, we thought, okay, how can we reach more people? So that's why we wrote the book. But the last chapter of the book is about LifeLock because the book is divided into three sections. And the final section is about developing a sense of mindfulness around your security. And part of that means that you have to, you know, fully take control of certain aspects of your life and not only make these changes that are fairly simple and will boost your security, but some of them you need to stay on top of and watch on a regular basis. And the problem with companies like LifeLock that they want to give you the impression that if you pay them, you know, $15 a month or $20 a month for your whole family or more, that you can just sign up and be perfectly fine and not have anything to worry about. And the truth of the matter is that you don't even need to spend any money with LifeLock to enjoy a considerable amount of security and as it relates to identity theft. What LifeLock wants you to do is they want you to keep your credit files at Experian and Equifax and TransUnion. They want you to keep your file in its current default mode, which is open. That means that any retailer that would want to check on a credit application in your name could just get on the internet or use their databases to check the validity and check your credit scores. So here's the problem with that. LifeLock enjoys the fact that it is kept open because then if somebody tries to impersonate you and take out credit in your name, LifeLock might find out about it at some point in time by monitoring your file and then tell you, oh, did you know that you now have a credit card with a $25,000 credit limit that was taken out through this furniture wholesaling company, for instance? And you would say, well, no, I didn't have anything to do with that. Okay. And then LifeLock would say, okay, well, we can step in and help you solve this problem. Now, we think that doesn't make any sense at all. We think that you should put into place a simple thing that we just have never allowed for that to happen in the first place. And that's called a credit freeze, okay? And so everybody who's listening, unless you are constantly applying for new credit all the time, and frankly, hardly anyone is, you want to go to the three credit bureaus, and it takes just a couple of minutes with each one, and you want to put your security, your credit files on a security freeze, also known as a credit freeze. And when that is done, your files are automatically by default closed, meaning that furniture company that could give you an application, that could give you a credit to totally refurnish your home or your apartment, someone impersonating you couldn't defraud them and you by going on and falsifying an application and taking out credit in your name because your credit files would be locked. They'd be in a frozen situation so that when that retailer contacted any of the three credit bureaus to process the application that the fraudster is trying to run through on your name, they'll come back and say, oh, I'm sorry, your credit is frozen. We can't do that until you lift the credit freeze. And of course, you can lift it with your own personal identification number, your own PIN.
So I actually did it myself. And you were right. It took, because I know we had spoken in advance and I was like, you know, you were going to recommend this. And I was like, let me just try it out myself. And it was really quick. It took 5 or 10 minutes per place. And it cost, I think, about $10 a piece. But what happens when I need to get a new credit card or if I need to apply for a mortgage or something like that? Now, then what do I have to do?
Funny you should ask because I myself, this last summer, while the book was in production, had to get a second mortgage. And as we were going through the process, they came back and said, oh, we can't get into your credit files. I said, oh, you're right, because I put them on a freeze. I said, which one are you checking? Because sometimes they don't go and look at all three. And they said, well, we're looking at, I think it was Experian. And I said, okay. So I logged into my Experian account and I lifted the freeze, and you have an option to lift it for 24 hours or a week or 30 days. And I just put it on 30 days because, you know, going through the mortgage process can take time. And at the end of 30 days, it automatically drops down into the frozen state again. So it's very simple.
That's great. And then does this work for children too, or what should people be thinking about?
So the children thing is complicated and it's scary. A number of industry experts will say that about 500,000 children a year suffer from identity theft, meaning somebody has taken their social security number and added that to some fake or their own personal information relating to where they live and taken out credit in under a child's false identity using the child's social security number. So this is not a good situation. And changes are starting to happen that would allow for all of us to, A, contact the three credit bureaus. We all must do this if you have minor children. You must contact the credit bureaus and ask them to do a search on your child's social security number to see if there's a credit file existing. If there is a credit file existing, that's really bad news. That means somebody has taken out credit, unless you have a teenager and you have signed off on them having a credit card. Otherwise, that's a bad problem. Now, most of the time, people are going to discover that there is no credit taking out in their child's name, and that's a good thing. So you've confirmed, at least up to this moment in time, that their social security number has not been used in a fraudulent manner. Now, here's where it gets a little tricky. The laws relating to this sort of thing are controlled at the state level. It sounds crazy, but it is. And so about 25 states in the nation will allow a parent to ask the credit bureaus to open a credit file there with their bureau in their child's name under that social security number and then freeze it, okay? But 25 states won't allow that. But it's been moving in the positive direction. But it is a difficult, difficult situation. And if anybody has ever, you know, seen credit card applications and things come in the mail in their minor children's names, then that's not necessarily a sign that there's credit fraud happening, but it is yet another indication that you might want to contact the credit bureaus and do a search on your child's name and just, you know, get a little peace of mind that your child isn't being impersonated by someone, and then put the freeze in place if your state allows it. Otherwise, you have to keep checking back from time to time.
Great. That's great information, Sean. I want to shift gears a little bit, and let's move away from protecting your identity for a bit, and let's just talk about, you know, exchanging information. And so for the people who are going through the divorce process now, they're often sending to me or to their attorney or to whomever else very, I'll just say, important information that might have addresses, social security numbers, or other just sensitive communications. And how do you protect that and keep that from getting hacked, or keep a spouse from maybe intercepting those communications, or just anyone in general from kind of tracking what's going on during this deeply personal time and with the sensitive information?
Yeah, so that's a really important question. And there's a couple different ways you can go about that. I think one thing for people to keep in mind is, you know, when you're choosing a divorce attorney or someone to work with, you definitely want to ask them about their security practices and make sure that they have methods in place to keep your information secure. Because like you said, Sean, you'll be sending that, you know, very confidential information, and you don't want that getting out. So the first thing is definitely to kind of do an audit of whoever you're working with and make sure they have things in place to keep you secure. But on your end, personally, I'm going to say the word encryption here, and I know that kind of scares people. It's very technical, but it actually isn't anymore. Technology has made it actually pretty easy to use encryption and send encrypted messages. In fact, a lot of the times you are sending encrypted messages and you don't even know it because whatever method you're using is done for you. For example, iMessage on your iPhone, that's encrypted by default. And you don't even know it. So if you're sending a message to another iPhone, that is encrypted, but you're not doing anything about it. But just a general overview of encryption, basically what that means is that when you send a message to someone else, to anyone outside of that conversation, it would look like a random string of characters. It wouldn't make any sense. But the person that you're sending it to has a special key, and they can use that key to unlock the message and read what you are really writing. And that key comes in basically the form of a passcode. So you're entering that in, and now you can read the message. So a lot of, you know, divorce attorneys in general will already have this in place where if you send them a message, you have to sign into some sort of secure platform in order to read the message and respond back. So you're not even going through your email if you're doing that through their platform. So that's encryption. And if your divorce attorney doesn't have something like that, there are services that you can use on your own. The one thing to keep in mind is that you both need to be using that service to have those communication between both of you.
Got it. And then, so what if I want to send like a PDF file or an Excel file? Is there a way to protect those as well?
Right. So one thing you can definitely do, and especially, you know, if the encryption thing is maybe too complicated, any zip file that you can put a password on that. So we recommend any sensitive documents that you're going to be sending via email, you put it in a zip file, you put a passcode on that, and you call the person that you're sending it to and give them that passcode. You don't want to be sending that, you know, in the same message. It kind of defeats the purpose. Another point we make in the book is creating a separate email address for your financial accounts. And the point of doing that is that you don't want the email address associated with your bank account to be the same email address that you're using to sign up for, you know, retail store coupons or different newsletters, because chances are that's going to get swept up in a data breach. You know, that company could get hacked and all of a sudden your email is now out there for anyone to see. So we recommend, you know, using a different private separate email for your financial accounts that has nothing to do with your name or your birth date or anything like that. But in this case, I think it also could work where, you know, if you're going to be sending this important communication, you can create a separate email that you only use when you're communicating with your divorce attorney or someone else in that situation. So now your spouse doesn't know that email. I'm sure they know your personal email, but they don't know the separate email that you've created. And if you're worried about them, you know, hacking in or knowing your password, that way you can avoid that because the separate email that you're only using for your communications on the divorce.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. And I know a lot of my clients have their own email address they just use for divorce communications, usually something random that no one really knows. And when the divorce is over, that's the last time they ever check it. You know, I saw in the news there was an issue with a governor of a state, and it has to do something with, I only know the high level details, but how iTunes and iCloud and all of that, the accounts are kind of linked as a family. Why don't you tell us a little bit more about, just briefly, about the situation and kind of how to avoid information getting shared in that case?
So yeah, now the former governor of Alabama was caught up in a scandal involving a mistress. And the long story short, basically what had happened was he was, you know, texting his mistress from his iPhone, but he had his iPad linked up to his iCloud. So they're both linked up to the iCloud. He was sending these text messages. His wife at home was using his iPad, and the text messages began popping up on the iPad. So all his communications with his mistress were now being read by his wife, and she leaked it to the public, and that's how that whole thing happened. But I think it highlights a really important point that people don't really think about is, you know, we have all of these different devices linked to one account, whether it's iCloud or Google, and it's super convenient because you can answer a text message on your phone or on your iPad or on your computer, no matter where you are. But when you're in a situation like divorce, you really need to take a look at that and separate, you know, your digital life now from your soon-to-be ex-spouse's digital life, because you don't want a situation where, you know, you're trying to send these messages or communicate with someone and your iPad sitting around and all of a sudden the messages are popping up. So it's important to keep in mind, you know, all your accounts that are linked with one another, but also with your spouse or anyone else in your family.
Got it. In the book, you talk, and you set a very good scene in that all it takes to lose or get hacked or lose a lot of personal information is a single click just on the wrong message or just something you shouldn't be clicking on, even though it looks like it's real. Why don't you tell us a little bit about, I think the term is phishing, and kind of how to protect yourself and make sure that anything you click on or put your information to is legitimate.
Right. So phishing is probably one of the biggest threats, and chances are that you see it every day, or even if you don't see it, you're getting the messages, your spam filter is just catching them. So what phishing is, you know, it's when a hacker or some malicious person wants to get your information or, you know, put malware on your device. And what they do is they send you an email, and that email appears to come from a legitimate company. And, you know, one of the most popular phish companies that we see is actually Apple. So I'll just use that as an example here. So they send you an email that looks like it's from Apple. It has Apple's logo. Maybe the from line says Apple support. And the message will have some, you know, urgent call to action. So maybe they'll say, we need you to update your billing information, or, you know, we'll delete everything in your iCloud. So something that's going to get someone to act very quickly. And either there'll be a link for you to click on that will lead you to a page that looks like it's Apple and ask you for, you know, your first name, your last name, your credit card information, your address, a bunch of information that someone could then go and use against you. Or it will make you click on a link, and that link will secretly download malware onto your machine. And that malware can record everything that you do. So anything that you type, your passwords, your usernames are being recorded by a third party. That's phishing in a gist. And there are thousands of phishing messages that go out every single day, and thousands of people fall for it. And it's really, really dangerous because a lot of them are so sophisticated now that they look real when you first look at it, and that call to action makes you act. But we do have a way in the book that we go into a lot more detail to combat that, and that's called the 10-second email rule.
Mm-hmm.
And here, email is an acronym, and that stands for examine message and inspect link. And we really believe that implementing this rule in your life can help you not fall for these phishing attacks and give all your personal information away. And how you do that, the first part, examine message. What we teach people is, you know, you really need to take a second look at where that email is coming from. So sure, you know, the from line may say Apple support, but is it really coming from Apple support? And the best way to find that out is to simply hover your mouse over that from line in the email. So when you do that, a little box will pop up. And it'll still say Apple support, but it will also show you the true full email address. And that email address may be, you know, just gibberish, a bunch of characters, and all of a sudden you realize that email's not coming from Apple. And that's your first guess, and you're like, no, this is wrong. And we always say, once you see that, you know, delete the message and don't click on anything. The second part of that is called inspect links. And this is where you're going to see, you know, you see those URLs in the email, but you can see exactly where they're actually leading you to, because most of the time it's either hyperlink text or it's a button that's telling you to click here, log in. So again, what you're going to do there is any URL in the email, you're going to hover your mouse over. And again, that same box will pop up with the true destination of that URL. And we really recommend doing this on every email that you get from a third party. And, you know, most of the time the email is probably legitimate, but this is the easiest way to, you know, get in the habit of really taking a look at any messages that you get. And if anything ever seems off, what you should do in that case, you know, if it's from Apple or if it's from Google or from American Airlines, is to just go to that site directly and try to take it from there. Don't click on anything in the email. You can call their customer support and ask, you know, did you send me this email? But really start taking a closer look at the message that you're getting and think about things before you click.
No, I think that makes a lot of sense. And, you know, I guess it seems like one of the biggest issues is the link can look real too. It'll be in blue or whatever the default link color is on your screen. It has a URL that's apple.com/support. But then when you hover over it, you're actually going somewhere else that you didn't intend to go, it sounds like.
Exactly. Exactly.
One other area I want to cover, and there's, I know, a bunch that we can cover and probably could talk for days about many of the subjects in the book. But one question that I also deal with a lot is how do you protect your bank accounts? Particularly if one spouse starts to withdraw a lot of money or is making suspicious withdrawals or transactions in general, how do you kind of protect yourself? And are there also just sort of things that people should be looking for or concerned about?
One aspect of the book, we introduce about 5 rules that address the topic of omniscience, or as stated better, financial all-knowingness. And what we say is that we need to use the technology just like the banks use the technology. They know up to the second exactly how much money is coming into or going out of any of our accounts or being charged to any of our credit cards or any other payment service. And the technology is in place for us to actually know, just like the banks do. And that comes about by simply logging into your credit card account or your bank account and to implement their alert services. And so you can find a spot with any of these accounts online, and you can tell them, send me a text alert every time money leaves my account that's above a certain amount. And it can be as little as $1. And that's what we recommend. We basically say, you want to know money that's leaving your account so that when you go to the ATM and withdraw, you know, $300 from your Chase account here in New York, before I even finish that transaction, my phone has dinged and I have an alert from Chase that says withdrawal of $300. And you can do this for your credit cards and any other payment service as well. And when you do that, you're at the center of your financial life. You're seeing the money leaving, and it acts as a safeguard. You can monitor what's going on. Every now and then, stuff doesn't, you don't get the alert instantly, but we get it within a few hours, and you'll see it, and sometimes you have to scratch your head a little bit and try and remember, oh yeah, okay, what's that? But if you start seeing, you know, some unusual, large or unusual patterns, you'll know, wait a second, something is not right, and you can investigate further. So that is a key aspect of another simple, low-cost protection that you don't need anybody to pay anybody else to do. It's easy enough. You can configure your accounts to do it, and you'll know exactly what's going on.
And what's the best place for people to learn more about you and the book and your recommendations?
If anybody is listening right now and they're at a computer, they can plug in the web address, the URL of hackproofquiz.com. And that will roll you over to a page that's associated with our book site, hackproofyourlifenow.com. And you'll take a 10-question quiz. And it will step you through the major aspects of all the topics we cover in the book. And you do the quiz, you answer yes or no, and then you'll get your own personal cybersecurity score. Now, don't be surprised. Most everybody's score is low. And that's, you know, really comes out of the first chapter of the book where we have people reading the book do the same quiz. But then we take you step by step through these three major sections of the book to implement a lot of the, you know, a number of the things that we just talked about today. And if you implement these things, you'll get some additional points and your cybersecurity score will literally start to grow. You'll be much better protected against the variety of frauds and hacks that really increase every single day. But that would be our biggest recommendation. Find out what your cybersecurity score is now and start taking these specific actions that will boost your security. You can do that by starting at hackproofquiz.com.
Excellent. I'll include a link to that in the show notes and also a link to the book on Amazon, Hack Proof Your Life Now. Well, Sean and Devin, this has been really informative. There's so much in here in the book and in this episode. Thank you very much for coming onto the show.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
We're almost done with the episode, but don't leave quite yet. Before you go, I want to make sure that you get the help you deserve. All you have to do is go to divorceandyourmoney.com, and the first thing that you do when you get there is sign up for the email list. You'll see a little box that says get updates and tips, and I will send you exclusive articles, content, and information that you will not find anywhere else, and it gets to go directly to you. The second thing that you do is consider getting one-on-one financial coaching. Look, divorce attorneys are good, but attorneys are not financial experts, and they can make many financial mistakes. I mean, even in the last episode, did they explain these details to you? Did they even bring them up, consider them? And I understand, because finances are really, really complicated. That's why there's over 100 episodes explaining different financial concepts. And sometimes you get to the point where the general information in the podcast, while helpful, you have the question is, how does it apply to me? How does it apply to my situation, my life and my divorce, and the only way to find out is to go for the one-on-one coaching sessions where I get to help you across the United States, whether you're near California, Texas, Ohio, Illinois, Florida, New York, everywhere in between. We work by phone, email, and in person. All you have to do is click on the coaching tab and fill out a few short questions, and we'll set up an introductory call to see if I can help you. The sooner you get started, the better. Even if you're still preparing financial information or waiting on your spouse to prepare financial information, we can help with that. Or if you're in the middle of negotiating and trying to decide what's right for you. But here's the deal, is once you've signed on the dotted line, you know, the mistakes today are pretty much permanent. And I don't want you to make costly mistakes during divorce. So be sure to consider the coaching, and the sooner you get started, the better off you will be. Finally, on divorceandyourmoney.com, there's just a ton of great resources on there. You can subscribe to the podcast, and if you have iTunes, leave a review, which helps other people discover this free information. I'm your host, Sean Lehman, MBA and Certified Divorce Financial Analyst. Thank you for listening. Take it off, take it over, take it out of control today.